Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Jeando Massaero, an Alexander Technique teacher who lives in Montpellier, France. Jeando and I have had a series of conversations about the influence of François Delsarte on F. Matthias Alexander and the Alexander Technique, and today we're going to go talk about Delsarte himself a bit more, a little history of his work, and we will point out where in that history Alexander got influenced by his work, but we're going to go past that into his later life as well. And a little bit of what we're saying we'll have covered in earlier podcasts, but this is basically a summary of Delsarte's career. So, Jeando, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And could you begin by just very briefly explaining how Delsarte became interested in what we might today call improving his use and functioning?
Yes. The story is very similar to Alexander's, with the difference that Delsarte was not a comedian. He was a singer. Mm-hmm. He was a fantastic singer. And despite his low upbringing, he was from a very poor family, he was invited in the foremost singing school in France, with the royal teaching of singing. And after 3 years of training, he was very dedicated. He lost his voice. Mm-hmm. And he was sure that it was through something he did himself. Mm-hmm. That the loss of voice appeared. Mm-hmm. So he didn't accept the condemnation of the doctors that said that he would never sing again. Mm-hmm. And he started to investigate on his own in order to find out how he had lost his voice through teaching and how he could recover it through a different form of mm-hmm. teaching. Mm-hmm. So he's been involved in teaching all his life. What happened is that he's 30 years after his discoveries, he wrote an extensive presentation and an evolution of his technique, which is quite similar to what Alexander did also. Mm-hmm. So we have only his words for his evolution of his technique. And he discovered that he was doing something with his larynx, which is the voice box in his mm-hmm. in his neck. And he found out that when he was singing high notes, he was raising his larynx, mm-hmm. as everybody does, in fact. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to find out if this was a condition of producing the voice or if it was an habit. And he discovered that it was, in fact, a habit, a bad habit, a nocive one. Mm-hmm. And he embarked into the process of finding a way to change a habit. Mm-hmm. And that's why he investigated the power of instructions, of reasoning, mm-hmm. of what he called the soul. Mm-hmm. And so, in his theory, there are three aspects of the soul, because and it's very important to investigate these aspects, because for him, the body or the movements, the gesture we produce, is just a representation of the soul. The body has no great presentation in his work. Mm-hmm. It's just an instrument. So he's got an extensive description of the soul. And for him, the soul is made of three parts. And he developed the three parts in his work. One is memory, the second one is understanding, and the third one is will. And he goes beyond that. He goes into showing the relationship between the three parts and how one can, in fact, change one habit that at first seems more an instinct or more something that is that's the way I think, that's the way I produce the voice. And he discovered that it was possible to, in fact, bypass the feeling, the sensory instinctive way of doing things, and to reason and to guide, in fact, the activity of the self through the conscious part of it. So he invented conscious guidance and control.
And so, just could we pause for just a second? Yeah. You said he wrote about this 30 years afterwards. He was doing this teaching and performing in really what the first half of the 19th century, 1830s, 1840s, in there.
Yes,
that kind of period. And the material that he wrote, is that the material that's only become available fairly recently?
Yes, exactly.
And it's in French. It's out there. I guess people can buy it, right? If they read French, they can read it.
Well, you don't even need to buy it because most of the work is are published as university work.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And,
okay. So it's available for anyone. And
that, I think you're making a very, very important point here. Mm-hmm. Because there are two different ways to understand Del Sartre, and you have to know that I choose one instead of the other. Mm-hmm. Because when Del Sartre died, he never published anything. So all we knew about Del Sartre before 2009, when the first manuscript was published, was through books written by his students.
Right, right.
And I would say it's exactly the same thing as you wanted to know what the Alexander Technique is, and you go onto the internet and you look at what people are writing about it, and there is very, very little of Alexander's words in what you will see. Well, in the Del Sartrean world, it's exactly the same. Many, many people have written after 1870. About the Del Sartre system, and we call that the Del Sartrean movement. But there is very, very little Del Sartre in it. Well, very, very little of the manuscripts of Del Sartre, of the ideas, the writings of Del Sartre. Right. So it's very important to say here that I'm not talking about the Del Sartrean movement. Mm-hmm. I've read many books about it, but I was not interested because when I started to study Del Sartre, it was for a reason. It was because I was translating Alexander's writings. French, and I wanted to have some more information about his principles, about his ideas. Right. And knowing that he had been a teacher of Del Sartre, it was, well, quite straightforward to try and find a correlation between their ideas. And then when I read the Del Sartrean writers, and I found nothing.
Right. It's only because this material is recently become available that you could really trace the connection between Del Sartre and Alexander. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And let's go back in time to the 1840s. Del Sartre is teaching his method, and he has also trained his two younger brothers, right?
Yes, that's correct.
One of whom went to America, and I think had quite a following in America. Is that correct?
Well, no, because you're talking about another man. He was not his son. He was an American citizen.
Oh, okay. But wasn't there a son who went to America, or am I mistaken about that?
Yes, I think it's much better to follow the trail of a guy called Mackay, and he was Del Sartre considered him as his son. which he was not.
Right.
He was not fathered by Del Sarte, but in fact he became his disciple at the end of his life, and that is quite important to understand because there was something.
Because we're gonna get to that. So anyway, this guy went to who studied with Del Sarte towards the end of Del Sarte's life. Was the Del Sarte ambassador, as it were, to America.
Yes.
And we're not going to really go into much detail on that, except to say, it, in your view, it doesn't have a lot to do with the earlier Del Sarte.
That's the idea I got from reading the Del Sarte manuscript.
And we'll just put it out there, is that that's your take on it, and you know, if people want to argue, they can.
Yes.
But I want to get back to then... It was just one younger brother who he trained. Is that right?
Yes, it's correct.
His name was Camille Del Sarte.
Yeah.
And he is the indirect connection to Alexander, because he ended up of all places, in Hobart, Tasmania. And he lived in Australia for almost 30 years, had a big influence on the music and theater community there. He taught in groups. He taught Del Sarte's method. He used Del Sarte's images, which we haven't really talked about, but maybe you could say a word or two about those images that Del Sarte and Camille used.
Well, Del Sarte invented a system to, in fact, note movements of the different parts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted people, in fact, to create movement from ideas.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want them to use what we call free expression or impulsive movements or intuition.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted them to have a vocabulary of movements of the parts. And mm-hmm. this vocabulary could be used in order to create any form with the human structure. You have to remember that it was he was after a system of expression
mm-hmm.
that you could transmit to an audience. For example, you want to transmit the feeling of fear or the feeling of joy
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
avishment, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And most comedians or most singers would try to find in themselves the root of these feelings. But Del Sarte found out that this was not at all working.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he wanted people to master a vocabulary of gesture
mm-hmm.
that would be transmitted to the public without the comedian experiencing any of the feeling he was transmitting to the public.
So very different from, say, the Stanislavski method approach, right?
Well, very different in a way, because in another way, we know now that Stanislavski was studied the Del Sarte system.
Oh, okay.
So, there were parts of the exercises of the Stanislavski system that were, in fact, Del Sarte.
Okay. But so, just to, because we're really doing a summary here, and we have covered a bit of this material in earlier podcasts, but Del Sarte used mirrors. He had people look at themselves, observe themselves in mirrors, and he gave them images he would create himself that would help them, would sort of guide them into relationships within their body that could express certain emotions, for example, on stage or or singing. And just, I think it's really important for our listeners to understand that Del Sarte was not especially interested in any of that in terms of how people functioned in the real world. He was aware that it helped them function better, but his interest was pretty much the output of singers and actors on stage.
Yes, correct.
And so all of his work was in service to that, really.
Yeah.
Now, Camille left France in the 1840s, late
1850,
ended up in Tasmania, I think, a year or so later. Yeah. Basically taught the same Delsarte method that Francois did. You have, it's your opinion that he wasn't quite as skilled with the images because Francois was really good at drawing, right?
Yeah.
But he had that same approach. And that's the connection to Alexander. Not that Alexander, it's almost impossible that Alexander would have encountered Camille in person, but he encountered his students, who were all over the place in Australia and Tasmania. And he almost certainly trained with one or more. And of course, then ultimately, Alexander advertised himself as a teacher of the Delsarte method. And we have letterhead of his that states that pretty clearly. So that's the connection with Alexander, right?
Well, but it's just the result of an inquiry, because we have no proof of that at the moment. What we know is that there is an uncanny resemblance between Alexander principles in writing and Delsarte manuscripts.
We know that he said he was a teacher of the Delsarte method.
He said he was a teacher, and we know that the Youngs, which is the former husband of his wife, of Alexander's wife, and she most certainly had lesson with Camille Delsarte, and they met the young Alexander when he was 17, so it's quite early in his life. Mm-hmm. It could explain the uncanny resemblance, but we cannot say for sure that it was the case. Maybe it would be so amazing that two people that were apart in time and space would have such similarities in principle. Mm-hmm. That seems unlikely, but there are things missing in Alexander's understanding.
Right. He didn't get the pure Delsarte, it seems. He didn't get the images, for example.
Yes.
And the implications of that, I think we should leave for another podcast. But he got a version of Francois' work via his younger brother, then he probably got a version of it via his younger brother and his younger brother's students in Tasmania and on the mainland of Australia. Mm-hmm. And we also, by the way, know from Alexander's fragment autobiography that he studied violin. He was a violin student as well as being a reciter.
Yes.
And of course, Delsarte had a big influence on music as well as theater.
Yes.
So we have all that. Now we have Delsarte. Now we're going to kind of the post Alexander connection, possible Alexander connection period. You have told me that Delsarte changed dramatically, what, in the 1850s, early 1850s?
Early
1860s. This is Francois Delsarte, still in Paris. And tell me what happened then.
Well, you have to understand first that Francois Delsarte was at a fight on his hand with the teacher of music of his time. Mm-hmm. And he was not at all accepted like we would think. Like, he was accepted later on in America and in Europe, mm-hmm. like a savior. But during his life, he was not. He was in a bitter fight because he had the strength, but also the folly to antagonize his own teachers. Mm-hmm. To antagonize the Royal Opera teachers. Mm-hmm. So it was not that easy. And what happened is that in the, early 60s, some of his students started to enter in singing competitions. And they were there to produce maximum output, maximum voice because of their training. And that infuriated Delsarte. Who thought that this was not art. This was a terrible way of using his technique. So he decided to stop teaching the gestural training. Mm-hmm. And he only taught the theory. And so there are, for example, today, the practice of the Delsart system, of the gestural training, is scant, is very, very thin. All you can find in his writings are, in fact, principles and general ideas of his way of teaching. It's not, well, do not think that by reading the French manuscript you are going to get the how to change the organization of the torso, because you will not. It's not, I didn't found this. I found principles. I found general ideas on how to organize memory, understanding, which is conception of movements, and the direction of the practical and intellectual will. That you will find. But nothing about the exact way he was teaching people how to reorganize their torso in order to be able to sing when they couldn't. So this is very important to understand, that nowadays, I think the Delsartian will agree with me, we know very, very, very little about the practice. And most practices that are now considered to be the Delsartian teaching are in fact borrowed from his own student, borrowed from his own disciples. And they do not resemble very much the principle that, because, for example, there is one big difference, is that when you train in the Delsartian movements now, you will see the importance of feeling, the importance of the body, which didn't exist in the Delsart mind. The body is the instrument. It's the different parts are the agents of expression, and you need to master a vocabulary of expression. And and it's very clear about the fact that you have to, in fact, subordinate the form to the plan you've got in mind.
So very similar to Alexander.
Yes, very similar to the early Alexander.
Early Alexander, we're talking
very
about.
Very early Alexander.
So I just want to add one thing, but then this might be a place to end this conversation. We have another conversation on Delsart coming up, which I forget how you phrased it. It's sort of what Delsart did that no one else did, or what was the general?
I said the forgotten Delsart.
The forgotten Delsart. We're going to get to that in the next. But we're still at the remembered Delsart. And your general take on things is that if you want to know what Delsart was about in terms of these gestural training and his work in actually helping people produce better sound or better theatrical performances, the place to go are the books of F. Matthias Alexander.
Yes, that was my discovery. The very big surprise is that I found that Alexander not only used Delsart teaching, or I think he used Delsart teaching because the principles are exactly the same, but he found a way to frame the Delsart principle in a gestural training that is really efficient.
Right.
A vocabulary of gesture that is really what, well, I found help in understanding Alexander in Delsart, and then suddenly I found that Alexander was throwing some light in the very, very strict and very bitter way that, not bitter, but the way in which Delsart is expressing things is very formal. Very, very complex.
Right.
And so I found that Alexander is the best way to understand Delsart.
Okay. And so so if anyone is interested in learning about Delsart's work, the place to go, it would seem to me, from what you say, are Alexander's four books. But you have to be able to read them with that in mind. And you, I know, are planning a project to take to break it down by individual sentences in Alexander's books and explain them in great detail. Am I correct on that?
Yes, it is.
And I assume that part of that's going to be is going to involve some Delsartean type discussions, right?
Yes, because in fact the whole project is a branch of Delsarte vocabulary. Delsarte, in fact, explained that to understand some text, to understand a sentence, mm-hmm. you have to understand its construction. Mm-hmm. And Delsarte is very clear about the fact that the construction of sentence in English or French comes from the syntax. So there is a very interesting text about syntax in Delsarte mm-hmm. Writings. And I use that in order to recreate a tool that helps to analyze sentences, complex one. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that sometimes Alexander's sentences are not that clear. And
kidding.
To help people, in fact, construct the tools in order to understand, well, for example, Alexander, but also Delsarte or any other writer that writes complex sentence, of course.
Okay.
And so yes.
Yeah. So that's coming up. That's something you're going to be doing in the next year or two or whatever. But I think this is the time maybe to end this podcast. And then we're going to have another one on the sort of hidden Delsarte. But so my guest today has been Jean Doe Massaero, an Alexander Technique teacher in Montpellier, France. Jean Doe, thank you.
Thank you very much.